Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved. And the host of the program, its founder and guiding light, is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Coming up in this program, she'll be talking with Jeff Greenfield, the news correspondent who wrote a very interesting book about John F. Kennedy. I know you've had a lot of Kennedy stuff this past week with the 50th anniversary having just been marked, but this one is really interesting. Had there been no 50th anniversary, in other words, had he lived? It's kind of a speculation of an alternate history. Very interesting. But let's kick the show off right now with Carol Marks in conversation with Steve Fox. He's one of the leading figures in the movement to create a legal, regulated marijuana market in the United States. He's going to talk about his new book, Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Interesting. Published by Chelsea Green Publishing.
For those that are unfamiliar with marijuana, what is it? I guess it has a couple of different species.
Sure. Well, it's the plant genus cannabis, and there certainly are different strains of cannabis with different THC content, CBD content, all kinds of different cannabinoids and terpenes and so on. There are different strains. But essentially, marijuana is a plant, first and foremost, and it's something that when ingested, either through smoking it or vaporizing it or putting it into edibles, that kind of thing, leads to intoxicating effects, pain-relieving effects, other medical benefits, and so on.
Now, I thought it was really important to talk about some of the common myths about this plant. And first, it's been widely said that it's a gateway drug, it's addictive, it's going to lead the user to harder drugs. So what has the latest research showed about that?
Well, I mean, you could look at all the different claims about marijuana, for example, that gateway claim that you asserted, that has pretty much been debunked. I mean, people, even by the noteworthy and respected RAND Corporation, they did a study and showed that there's really no truth to that rumor. And you know, the idea that marijuana use will lead you to other hard drug use, just there's no evidence for that. If anything, the only thing, the connection between marijuana and hard drugs, is the fact that they're currently sold in the same market, and that can expose consumers to harder drugs, and they may purchase them. But in terms of the health effects of marijuana, those have been exaggerated as well. For example, they have always said, you know, folks have always said marijuana kills brain cells, but in fact, marijuana protects brain cells, and the U.S. government actually has a patent on marijuana, the cannabinoids in marijuana, as a neuroprotective agent. So they even know that it protects brain cells. And lung cancer is another thing that's always been thrown around.
True.
They would say that it has, you know, more carcinogens than cigarettes and so on, but studies that have been done, including a major study at UCLA, demonstrated that there really is no connection between marijuana and lung cancer, and in fact, there's no documented case of lung cancer among any marijuana-only smoker, if you take tobacco out of the equation.
Can you briefly tell our listeners why our federal and state laws today make alcohol legal, but marijuana is illegal, when throughout most of American history, both were legal? What happened? Because I really didn't know till I read your book. I found it fascinating.
Sure. Well, I mean, it was really a response to, I guess you could almost call it a racist response to an influx of individuals from Mexico into the United States, and there became this association with the plant and Mexican immigrants, and it basically started on the state level starting in the early 1900s. You had states starting to make marijuana use illegal, and that happened on a state-by-state basis. But then after alcohol prohibition ended, it seemed almost as if the federal government was looking for some other substance to ban and turn their prohibition efforts toward, and they ended up banning marijuana on the federal level, actually through a federal tax act. But they effectively banned it based on very thin evidence, and there was really most people had no idea what they were even voting on, but word was that there was some dangerous plant and we need to make it illegal, and it was really made illegal without much thought.
And in 1970, Congress said that marijuana was going to be a Schedule I drug, which is the highest classification you can get, making a drug illegal. But that classification was only supposed to be temporary, and I never knew about that.
Yeah, that's correct. When they were putting the Controlled Substances Act together and scheduling all the substances, there was a little bit of controversy about marijuana, whether it belonged in Schedule I or not, because certainly there were some people by that point, having been through the 60s, with awareness of marijuana and knowing that it was being used. But the question was whether it really belonged in Schedule I as the most dangerous of substances. And it was temporarily placed in Schedule I, pending a study that had been commissioned by the Nixon administration that ended up producing the Schaefer Report, as it's commonly known. And that report basically said that the harms of marijuana do not even really justify any criminal penalties, and that they represented maybe that it just be a finable offense, but they did not support it remaining in Schedule I. However, Congress never did anything to change that.
Very, very interesting. And now, of course, marijuana is classified, and you can get into a lot of trouble according to the amount that you have on you, and it can lead to a felony arrest. And I guess a half of all the illicit drug arrests nationwide have to do with pot. And isn't this expensive to us as taxpayers? Because an awful lot of people are winding up in jail, and we're paying a lot of money to keep them there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt where the nation overall is spending billions of dollars annually to keep marijuana illegal. There are people, hundreds of thousands, about 800,000 people a year, between 700,000 and 800,000, arrested for mere marijuana possession. In some cases, it may just be a fine. In some cases, you may spend a couple days in jail. In some cases, it could be worse. But the fact is, these are law enforcement resources being used, whether it's to stop someone, write a ticket, process an arrest, whatever it is. And it's all for a substance that's far less harmful than alcohol. So it's just an irrational and inefficient and wasteful use of law enforcement resources, and we should direct police towards far more serious crimes.
And here we are in very tough economic times. So wouldn't taxing and regulating legalized marijuana bring in some badly needed revenues for the government and the states?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt. Right now, the profits from marijuana flow oftentimes, well, almost always, underground, and then many times towards drug cartels and other countries and so on. And that's all money that could stay in the United States. I mean, we see in Colorado, where they have a fully regulated system for medical marijuana right now, and they're expanding to all adults on January 1st, they've generated will generate in this fiscal year $300 million in legal sales reported to the state, taxed and so on, producing, I think, around $15 million for state and locals in tax revenue. And that will just be even greater next year when non-medical sales are legal and the tax rate is a little bit higher.
Now, when it comes to enforcing the marijuana laws, I noticed that in the foreword to your book, that the former police chief of Seattle, Washington, wrote it, and he thinks marijuana laws are counterproductive from his experience being a police chief. Do you think there are other law enforcement officials out there that feel the same way? Have you heard from any others?
Sure. There's actually an organization called LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and there are many law enforcement, mostly former law enforcement officials who are part of that and advocate for a new approach to the war on drugs in this country, because it clearly isn't working.
Now, also, our doctors, such as one of my favorites on CNN, I've interviewed him a couple of times, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and also some other health organizations now acknowledging marijuana's therapeutic value.
Yeah, and it's been a long time coming. I mean, this is something that's been known for a long time, anecdotally through studies that have been done. And it's just common knowledge. Most people know that, for example, it's helpful to use marijuana when you're going through chemotherapy to alleviate the nausea that you feel. But that's just one example. There, it's a list too long to even go through. But Sanjay Gupta on the show that he had on CNN had an incredible story about a young girl actually who was suffering endless numbers of seizures, and by taking marijuana, I believe pills with high CBD content, which is another of the top two cannabinoids along with THC in marijuana, was able to have those seizures greatly diminished, perhaps even stopped almost entirely. So the medical benefits are there, and unfortunately the U.S. government has blocked research for a long time, so we haven't made as much progress on the research side. But there is a company called GW Pharmaceuticals in out of England that is now approved. Their product Sativex for multiple sclerosis has been approved in 20 or more countries at this point, and they're attempting to be approved in the U.S. It's a whole plant alcohol-based extract that you spray under your tongue, but it's really the benefits of cannabis that are included.
That's Steve Fox. The book is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Published by Chelsea Green Publishing. For more information, go to saferchoice.org. The Institute. The interview was conducted by Carol Marks. Coming up next, Carol Marks and Jeff Greenfield when A Touch of Gray continues.
A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and it's time again for Carol Marks to conduct an interview of interest. The interviewee is Jeff Greenfield. He is a 5-time Emmy Award-winning analyst and has been a correspondent and commentator for major television networks, as well as a writer for major newspapers and magazines. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book, If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History, published by G.P. Putnam Sons.
Now, this is your second book of alternate history. Your first was Then Everything Changed, and it became a bestseller. So what is alternate history, and why do you find it so interesting?
Yeah, it's always fascinated me. It's a way of looking at what happened, plugging in the very small changes that might have happened, and then asking how would history have been different if these tiny little twists of fate had fallen one way or another. In John, the last book I did of this, I talked about how John Kennedy almost was killed by a suicide bomber in Palm Beach in 1960 before ever becoming president. That actually almost happened. Well, in this book, I revisit Dallas and suggest that a change in the weather, had the rain kept falling, would have kept the bubble top on his car, not bulletproof, but possibly enough to deflect a bullet, making his survival a lot more likely. and so change the weather in Dallas, keep John Kennedy as president, and then start asking how would his presidency continuing, as opposed to a Lyndon Johnson presidency, changed American history. And I would argue there would have been significant changes.
Oh, you know, and you really make a great point of pointing them out in the book, what they might have been. And you have a great personal knowledge of politics. What other research did you do for this book that made you come up with, you know, the scenario, which I thought was really very realistic about how President Kennedy, if he lived, would have handled some of the issues in our country?
First, I talked to a number of historians, like Doris Goodwin, like Michael Beschloss. I interviewed some of the principals, like many of the leaders of the protest movement, to see if my instinct was right, that without a Vietnam War, you would have had a much less violent, divisive protest movement. And then I just read a lot. I mean, my argument that Kennedy would not have escalated the war in Vietnam comes from all kinds of documents, National Security Council meetings, transcripts of phone calls, differing opinions of historians, of which the majority say, given his temperament, given his skepticism, given what he'd gone through with the missile crisis and his desire to ease up on the Cold War rhetoric, which he'd run on in 1960, the odds, and that's all we're talking about, the odds are that he would have found a way to disengage Vietnam. He'd also said that to people, that he was acutely aware of the political danger of being seen to be soft on communism. So he would say, you know, once I'm reelected, I think I'm going to have the running room to figure out how to get out of this. Because I think he did see it as a potential quagmire, a place that was not crucial to American security interests. He had a very kind of cold, if you want to, or cool approach. You know, if Vietnam eventually falls to the communists and we're out of there and it's not our war, we can live with that. It's not going to threaten, you know, the domino theory that he once believed in, that if Vietnam falls, all of Asia falls.
Well, you know what you've pointed out, though, something that I hadn't realized, Jeff, and that was the fact that so many of his advisors were pushing so hard to escalate the war, and I just saw he was under all this pressure.
Yes, but he had resisted. You know, what's interesting about that is all the short administration that he had, he was always under pressure someplace to do something militarily. Before he came into office, he was urged to go into Laos and you know, to save it, an even more obscure country. His military people wanted him to follow up the Bay of Pigs failure by committing American forces. He refused. One of his generals wanted him, when the Berlin Wall went up, to confront the Soviets militarily. He said, no, I'm not risking nuclear war over that. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, many of his advisors said, we've got to take those missiles out, you know, by force. He said, no, I want to give Khrushchev a chance to get them out. So you look at that pattern, and it's one of the reasons why I think when he died and Johnson came in with a different set of beliefs, he was much more inclined to follow the guidance of most of his advisors and escalate that war. I think he lacked the knowledge of the world that Kennedy had, even though he was much better at the Congress than Kennedy was, which is why it's unlikely Kennedy would have had the domestic success that Johnson had. You know, that's what I mean. You look at presidents with their strengths and weaknesses, and you figure out how would they have played out if the personalities had been different. How would history have played out given their leadership as opposed to the people who, in fact, were there?
And I came away from reading your book thinking about foreign policy, you know, in a different way, because the president was against some of the things that our government is still pursuing, supporting foreign rulers no matter how brutal they are when it comes to human rights, as long as they protect our interests. And that's still going on.
Well, he was caught in between. I mean, he was a realist. And so his motto was something like a cold handshake for our authoritarian friends and a warm embrace for the Democrats. But he certainly, in Latin America, had he been around, I think you would have seen a much more intense effort to embrace the Democrats, small D Democrats, as opposed to, you know, generals or dictators.
Now, of course, as a president, President Kennedy had lived through his second term. his policies would have also impacted our culture. So how do you think the 60s hippie movement would have been affected if the Vietnam War had ended and the draft had ended then?
Well, as I said, you would have had a far less confrontational youth movement. I think you would have had a lot more people, young people, engaged in public life through things like the Domestic Peace Corps. I just think it would have been a more upbeat, optimistic time because with the war so darkened American politics for so long. That absent that, I think you just have a different climate.
And is there any other message that you wanted your readers to take away from your book that we haven't touched on in regards to what his policies might have been if he'd lived?
I think what I'd want the readers to take away is a broader notion of how contingent history is. There's a saying, if you want to hear God laugh, tell her your plans. And I think what I've learned about history is, boy, is that true. You know, you can make these great predictive notions or these great sweeping statements about how history works, but a lot of times it just works because the coin flips on heads instead of tails.
And, you know, in a way, I think looking at our present President Obama, he has some of the foreign policy cool that the Kennedy has, you know, trying not to get involved.
I just am really skeptical. I don't know how to take an era a half a century away or a figure a half a century away and bring them into the present. That to me, is an exercise. I just don't know how to do it. You know, there are people arguing Kennedy was a conservative because they go back to his 1960 hawker speeches, and then there are people who argue that, well, Kennedy would, you know, Obama's another Bobby Kennedy, and I just don't buy any of that. I think I'm content to keep these figures in the era they were in because that's the way to judge them.
That's Jeff Greenfield in conversation with Carol Marx, and his book is titled If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History, published by G.P. Putnam Sons. Up next, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine, and then Steve Wiseman joins us. Plenty more coming your way when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to that point in the program where we're joined by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, who is also the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, which serves the talk radio industry. And Kevin, we just heard a very interesting conversation between Carol Marks and Jeff Greenfield about what would have happened had Kennedy lived.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here we are, you know, just past the 50th anniversary of his assassination, and talk radio was just full of conversation about it, as was the rest of the media. But the final word probably for a while on this is, the Kennedy assassination happened a half a century ago. We live in a time when the media is obsessed with youth, and that even rock stations don't play the Beatles in many cases because they feel it was upper demos. I think this fits our upper demographic mission. Did stations have a problem dealing with the Kennedy assassination because, you know, most people were not around anymore that are in the target demographic?
Not all at all. This is one of those events, historical events, that really transcends, age and demographics. It's such an important part of American history. There's so many people still alive who remember it, were there, and were able to talk about it, that younger people found that fascinating, not just because of that, but because of the event in and of itself.
The talk radio business deals constantly with the issue of, you know, the audience is aging, and yet older folks seem to like this kind of radio. Young people don't seem to necessarily gravitate to it. How big an issue is this in talk radio?
Talk radio is grappling with this, and many operators are wondering whether this is more perception than reality. What do young people really want? And I dare say that I don't know that a lot of people these days, it's a shame to say it, really know what young people want or what they care about, as much as they perhaps should.
Fascinating. Thank you, Kevin Casey, Vice President and Executive Editor of Talkers Magazine. Folks, you want to know what's going on in the talk radio field? Go to talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Grey continues in just a moment.
Did you know? An estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea, and most of them don't know it? Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment. Or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and it's time for our senior correspondent Steve Wiseman to join us for the rest of this hour. He's in conversation now with Dr. Daniel Davis. He's a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in the UK, where he's the director of research at the Manchester Collaborative Centre for Inflammation Research. He's going to talk about his new book titled The Compatibility Gene, How Our Bodies Fight Disease, Attract Others, and Define Ourselves, published by Oxford University Press.
Dr. Davis, how significant a scientific breakthrough was the decoding of the human genome?
So the decoding of the human genome was obviously a pivotal moment for humankind, where we really worked out what all the genes are that make up a human being, what it is, what the code is that defines what it means to be human. And that was really a seminal moment. And my book is actually about the part of that human genome that differs the most from one person to the next. That is, what is it in our human genome that's different from one person to the next, and that's what I'm particularly interested in this book.
And what I found fascinating was I didn't realize the extent of our own genetic makeup and how incredibly different it can be from person to person. You know, we're all people, but it really can range tremendously. Isn't that correct?
Right. So, well, much of our genome is the same. We have about 25,000 genes. And most of those genes are the same from one person to the next, but there are differences. And so, for example, genes that control things like our hair color, eye color, skin color can vary from one person to the next. Roughly, you know, a very small fraction of the human genome does vary from one person to the next, specifically about 0.1%. So 99.9% of our genes are the same. But the genes that differ the most from one person to the next actually have nothing to do with obvious physical differences like hair color and eye color. the genes that differ the most from one person to the next are important in our immune system. So the thing that makes you most different from me would be our immune system genes, the genes that are important in how we fight off disease. And for me, that's fascinating and actually, yeah, quite surprising.
You know, along those lines then, what it leads to is the issue of specialized medical treatment for perhaps the same disease because our immune systems are different, tailored to our genetic makeup. Is that where medicine is headed?
Right, so that is one of the paths that medicine might take in the reasonably near future. I mean, it's certainly clear that if you and I got infected with a particular flu virus, you might recover in, you know, a week and I might take 10 days. And one of the reasons for that difference in how well we react to any specific disease is caused by our differences in these genes. I mean, there are other reasons as well, but one of the important things is the versions of these genes that we have. And then, given that we might respond differently to any particular disease or any particular germ, then it's not that much of a stretch to think that the genes might also influence how we respond to a particular medicine. So exactly as you say, in the relatively near future, we might be given medicines according to which versions of these genes we have. And already there's some examples of that. So for example, one particular drug that's given to people with HIV, infected with HIV, people can develop quite bad side effects to that drug. And you can check which versions of these compatibility genes people have. And if you don't give that drug to people with certain versions of genes, then you can avoid them having these bad side effects.
What's the connection between our brain and our immune system?
That's a fascinating question. And there's evidence. So these genes that are crucially important for our immune system do seem to play a role in whole other areas of human biology. And that includes them being important in some aspects of the way that the brain works. And aside from just these particular genes that my book focuses about, there's lots of other ways that the brain, the nervous system, interacts with our immune system through, for example, hormones and changes that and other components that move through our blood triggered by what our brain is doing can influence the way that immune cells behave. So there's a complicated interaction between the nervous system and the immune system. And quite frankly, it's a crucial area of new research. And we understand perhaps relatively little about how that works. You know, we all know that you feel sad when you're ill, and also how sad you might feel can influence how quickly you might recover from an illness. But really understanding that in great detail is really one of the frontiers of current science.
You are one of the bravest people I've ever known, because in reading your book and discussing your own genetic profile and that of your wife, you had the, some would call it courage, some would call it, well, a little bit risky, to indicate that your wife has Neanderthal genetics in her profile. How'd that go over at home when you told her she's a Neanderthal?
In popular level, you know, it's kind of, yeah, it's amusing and it's pretty funny. But actually, you know, there's a lot of Neanderthal genes in humans, or there's quite likely to be quite a lot. There's reasonable evidence that modern humans bred with these historic species, and there has been, you know, there's evidence that genes did mix, and so many people probably have the genes that would have come initially from breeding between these different species. So it's probably not uncommon, but it's quite fascinating to think about that. You know, all of these versions of these genes that we have a geographic distribution,
sure,
which comes from the way that humankind spread throughout the world over the history. And you know, so it's quite fascinating to realize that, you know, your genetic makeup in effect tells the whole story of human migration and the peopling of the world. In fact, another way to think about that is the versions of these genes that we have often correlate with the languages that people speak, because languages also evolved similarly throughout the world as people initially spread into different parts of the world. So there's a fascinating complex history and geographic distribution to these versions of these genes that people have.
Is there an element of people with, and you mentioned how many thousands of genes we have, is it an element of people with a certain set of genetic makeup would be attracted to, and maybe couldn't even discern why, to someone with another particular type of genetic makeup? Is there that, you know, not just necessarily one person, but is there a type of person to whom we would be attracted?
Okay, so attraction is another area where it's fascinating, but it's also very complicated. So, there are experiments done where, for example, there were some controversial experiments where women would rank the smell of T-shirts worn by men for a couple of days, and there was some experiments indicated that women would prefer the smell of T-shirts worn by men who had different versions of compatibility genes to themselves. Now, those data and experiments are controversial, because one of the important reasons why they're controversial is because if women would rank the smell of T-shirts, say, to give them a score of 5 out of 10 rather than 4 out of 10 as being more attractive, it's still hard to know whether a score of 5 out of 10 versus 4 out of 10 for a smell would actually influence a woman's behavior. And so that's hard to know. But the really, really, really important message from all of that work is not that any particular person would be particularly attractive or more attractive. There's nobody with a perfect set of genes, right? We are all resistant or susceptible to different diseases according to the versions of genes we have, and no one has a perfect set of genes. The system works by keeping our immune system genes as diverse as possible. So the way that we fight off disease actually requires us to each have different versions of these compatibility genes. So in a way, this whole system and my whole book is a celebration of human diversity. There's a really fundamental importance to why we have to be unique.
Let me ask you, should we all, as a part of our, personal dealing with our health, should we have a genetic profile done and find out what our genetic makeup is, and what would we do with that information?
So I think that's quite a personal thing for each individual to decide. So one of the aims of my book was to, you know, discuss with people what it means to have your, well, what it means to have specific versions of these genes. But I'm not suggesting that you should or shouldn't know more about which versions of genes you have. I think that's a personal decision, and it's good to be fully informed about what it means and then make a personal decision about what you want, you know, what you want to do. And I think it'll be, the issue will come up more and more as science progresses. There'll be more and more situations where you will have the opportunity to find out about your particular genes, and you'll have to make an informed decision about whether you want that information, and if so, what to do with it.
That's Dr. Daniel Davis from the University of Manchester in the UK. His book is titled The Compatibility Gene, How Our Bodies Fight Disease, Attract Others, and Define Ourselves, published by Oxford University Press. The interview was conducted by Steve Wiseman, and Steve Wiseman will be back in a moment to discuss holiday shopping from a very interesting angle. Stand by. A Touch of Grey continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best. So take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat. We come to the final segment of our hour and more conversation with Steve Wiseman. Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. He's an attorney, obviously. He's a ubiquitous author. I mean, he is everywhere with so many fine books, including The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. And he also, speaking of scams, has a website that is a definite place to go for resources dealing with scams. It's called scamaside.com. Well, as far as scams are concerned, they certainly don't take a vacation during the holidays, and Steve is here to discuss holiday shopping. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, this is a time of year when we start thinking of goodwill to all and shopping. Somehow shopping doesn't seem to fit into me with goodwill to all, but it is something that we're all going to be doing, holiday shopping. And a lot of us try to do it online. It's really quick and easy. It's also a quick and easy way to lose your money to identity thieves and scammers. So, you know, I'm not saying don't shop online. As a matter of fact, I think you should. And you might even be safer in doing it online than in a brick-and-mortar store. But if you are going to do it online, do it smartly. And one of the first things to notice is you'll get pop-up ads, and maybe even with coupons in them. Don't click on them. You have no idea where those are coming from. So if you see something like that, it could be full of malware that could steal all the information from your computer and turn you into a victim of identity theft. So if there's something that does appear to be just a little bit interesting and enticing,
go to the website of the particular company, and make sure it's a legit company. But we'll talk about that in a moment. But go to their website, and if it's a legitimate coupon, you'll find it there. But, you know, speaking of legitimate companies, deal with companies that you know. You know, deal with the big guys like the Amazons. And I'm not saying this out of any, you know, great love of Amazon. But the thing is that if you Google a particular product or store and a company comes up as one of the top choices, that doesn't mean that they're legitimate, because the hackers are very good at what they call SEO, which is search engine optimization. They know the keywords to get them up at the top of a Google search. Google doesn't vet these companies out, so you may be getting into a company that's going to grab your money. So stick to the stores that you know. You also want to make sure that your computer is good, and you don't want to be using Wi-Fi in public places, because you never can be sure about that. Do it at home. Do it on a secure computer. Do it with encryption data so that you know that the data that you're sending out is being encrypted. And make sure all of your anti-malware and antivirus software is up to date. If it sounds like it's pretty scary, it is. But you know something? You're still probably safer shopping online than going out to the stores if you just take a few precautions.
Ho, ho, ho. Well, I think that's funny. Thanks for the information, Steve Wiseman. And again, check out scamaside.com or The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. All great works of our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Steve. And thank you, Beverly Santanello, on the front line, our producer. Thank you, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, Kevin Casey, and the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us here next week for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.